Hi, this is Dave, and it's been 3 years since we launched Galactic Netcasts. And over that time, some shows have come and gone, but the one thing that stayed the same is our commitment to you, the best listeners on the internet. And that's why we're asking for your help. For as little as $1 a month, you can help us build the best sci-fi, science, and geek culture-based podcast network in the galaxy. And all you have to do is go to patreon.com/galacticnetcasts. That's Patreon, patreon.com/galacticnetcasts. Thank you for your support, and on with the show!
We interrupt this program to give you a bulletin just received from one of our naval units at sea. A large object traveling at supersonic speed is headed over the North Atlantic toward the east coast of the United States.
This earth of yours will be reduced to a burned-out cinder.
This could be the beginning of the end for the human race. Human beings cower before the onslaught of these unearthly enemies.
It is Thursday, September 4th, 2014. Welcome to another Galactic Netcast. This is the Alien Invasion number 116 in Ottawa, Ontario, Canada. I'm Dave Nelson. Joining me, as always, Brad Ludwig and Anessa Moyens in Wausau, Wisconsin. How you guys doing?
Awesome.
I'm thirsty.
That's something that you would say at the end of the show, Anessa.
Oh, sorry, but I'm thirsty now.
That'll be your final thought at the beginning.
Well, I have water, so maybe by the end of the show I'll be properly hydrated.
Okay, just take it easy. Don't be like my rabbit who drinks like half his bottle in one take. We always worry about the rabbit. We think he's going to... Is it possible to over-drink? I don't know.
It is, actually. Oh. You can die from drinking too much water, and it's because it... basically dilutes the salt levels in your body, and that somehow affects things, and then you die.
That's right. That radio station had that contest, and those people got in trouble. Yep. Yeah, I forgot about that.
That prompted us to make some changes with our contest rules.
Yeah. You know, leave it to a couple people to screw things up for the rest of us.
Yeah.
All right, hey, this is the Netcast that we talk about things and people and creatures from elsewhere in the universe. I knew I'd get there eventually. And their appearances in film, TV, video games, comic books, science, and in real life. It's the Alien Invasion. Extraterrestrial aliens is what we talk about here. The show is divided into three sections. The news, the craft corner. That's the spotlight of a certain kind of alien spacecraft. And our picks for the week. And this week, we are doing a joint pick. You'll have to... stay tuned to find out what the joint pick is all about. We do the show live on Google Plus Hangouts every Thursday, or about every Thursday, as often as we can. And just follow us on Facebook, Google Plus, and Twitter, and find out when and where that's going to be, so you can watch us live or watch us later at youtube.com/galacticnetcasts. You guys ready?
Absolutely.
All right, let's get the show on the road, and hang on one second. I got to find the right thing. Here we go. Hang on, it's not playing. Damn it. My soundboard's not working. There we go.
Hey.
That's in the news. All right, so Anessa, you got the first story. What do you got?
Top 10 places to see UFOs.
Yay!
Yay! Although I'm only going to go over 5 of them. So
okay.
People can actually go check out the list. This came from a website that I'm not at all familiar with, but it's called successfulmeetings.com.
What? Sounds like a business website.
That's what it sounds like. I think that's how they get people to come to their website, and then they rope them in with their successful meetings tips.
Okay.
Ha ha ha. But I thought it was interesting. So at number 10 on the list is Sochi, Russia. Reports Radio Times, before the 2014 Winter Olympics, Sochi was not in the headlines for sportsmen in spandex, but flying objects potentially carrying aliens in similar attire. The Black Sea coast is a particular UFO hotspot where locals are said to have seen luminous objects and flying saucers.
I wonder if there's any saucers that came up from the ocean, you know, those the ocean UFOs.
Maybe, like in the X-Files, where they come out from under the ice sheet and take off.
Yeah. Maybe there's a base in the Black Sea, a UFO base.
It's possible. I saw something about a base being off of the coast of Florida. Was it Miami?
And then we talked about one off the coast of the west coast of the U.S. too.
Yeah, so there's one on each coast, apparently. I want to say it's Miami. It's somewhere off of Florida, though.
So the world is being run by aliens? Is that what we're saying here?
Yes, totally. Totally it.
Okay.
No, not really.
No, not really.
So the next one on the list I picked out just randomly, number 8, Wycliffe Well, Australia. UFO spotters date back to World War II in this little spot in the Stuart Highway between Alice Springs and Tennant Creek. The Wycliffe Well Holiday Park seems to be a particular attraction. They have lots of UFO paraphernalia, alien statues, and souvenirs to get you into the UFO spotting mood.
You know, that's down under. Woo-hoo. That's down under.
Really? I didn't realize Australia was in the Southern Hemisphere.
It's down under. Yep. They got, not only do they have
UFO.
They come
from a land down under?
Yeah. And where the women do something. I forget the rest of the lyrics to that song.
They do something and something else.
They do stuff and things. And
they do the things.
You know, like, it actually kind of reminds me, like, this Wycliffe Well place in Australia reminds me a bit of Roswell as it is today with all of their souvenirs and UFO paraphernalia.
Oh, yeah.
It's like the Southern Hemisphere's version of Roswell.
Yeah, totally.
Except without the 1947 crash.
But it goes back to World War II, right? So it's around the same time.
Yeah, actually. So it is around the same time. But yeah, I don't know if an alien ship actually crashed there. It's just a really popular hotbed of UFOs. So
yeah, it seems like any...
I'll have to look up the story on that one.
Yeah, any place in the world, it seems like, that has regular occurrences of UFO sightings, they always kind of capitalize on that. Like, the road to Area 51, they've got a bunch of, like, UFO-themed restaurants and stores and stuff like that, so...
Yeah, and that one was actually on the list. I didn't include it on here just because it was on the list, and it's something that's mentioned quite a bit. There was... Oh, man, I forgot where. Oh, Scarborough over in the UK. There's a UFO hunter that's trying to encourage the council over there to kind of gear things towards something similar with, like, stories about UFOs and alien statues and souvenirs and stuff to try to attract more tourists, which I thought was kind of interesting. They're like, you need to do this. People will come. And the people of Scarborough were like, well, we don't know. Maybe, maybe not. So that was the last thing that I heard, was some guy was really campaigning to encourage them to be more of a UFO-centric community.
Hey, you know what? If it brings the tourists in and brings the dollars in, I say go for it.
It brings the dollars. Dollars bring jobs. It helps maintain everything, keep everything looking good and running. So, I mean, but then again, you could also argue with more people brings more crime, blah, blah, blah.
Hey, that's the glass half empty attitude, Moines. None of that.
Well, I'm just trying to see it from both sides. I could see how, you know, one person, because that's his thing. He's saying that, you know, it's a really good idea because it's going to bring in income. It's going to help with jobs. It's going to help with the city overall. And then another person could come along. I'm not saying that they have, but they could come along and argue, well, with more people and more money, then there's more potential for conflict and crimes and whatnot. And I know small town people don't really want that sort of thing.
All right.
It's everywhere.
Okay, next.
All right, so anyway, also Scarborough was not on the list. Number 7 was Mexico City, Mexico. During a solar eclipse in 1991, everything started getting a bit fishy in Mexico City. People started spotting UFO left and right and center. UFOs left, right, and center. In the mid-90s, someone managed to get some proper footage on a camcorder while the UFO was flying over restricted airspace. Then later, in 2005, thousands of people witnessed hundreds of lights and objects moving around in the sky. So, crazy. And then number 4, just kind of skipping around, the Falkirk Triangle in Scotland. The town of Bonnybridge supposedly gets a whopping 300 sightings a year, and local residents have consistently asked for proper government investigation into these oddities. Previous witnesses have seen flying discs, floating cigar-shaped objects, and cubes.
I totally want to move there. That sounds like a fun place.
Well, Scotland is beautiful to begin with. Like, I would totally move there if other people were willing to move there. But we'd have to move a small army to Scotland. But yeah, like, you would get a wonderful view, and you would get to see potential aliens flying around in space. 300 sightings a year. That's almost one each day.
Yeah, no, and they want government investigations. So it's got to be, like, something that is a pretty common thing for them, right?
Yeah, it sounds like it's fairly common for them. I mean, they might get multiple in a night, but if you average it out, there's 365 days in a year, so there's at least 65 days out of the year that they don't see a UFO.
That's crazy.
If you had one sighting per day.
You know, it'd be fun to be like, be a UFO tourist and hit all mm-hmm. hit as many of these spots as you could, you know?
Yeah, no, it would be great. And a lot of these places I would love to go to and see, like, even taking out the UFO factor, and that would just be a bonus.
Oh, yeah.
Just to go travel, see if you can see anything. And if not, well, then you get to see a cool place and you get to collect like a little UFO keychain or something and call it good.
Bumper stickers.
Yeah. Well, you know, they have like the national parks or state and national parks now have this thing where it's a circular bumper sticker and it has the letters. So like Jackson Hole is JH. And it'd be kind of cool if some of these places would do something similar so you could stick it on the back of your car and people would know, like, oh, man, they totally went to Falkirk Triangle in Scotland. That would be awesome.
I was there,
man. Apparently on one of the 65 days where there's not an alien.
Yeah.
It'd be my luck. Or if it's cloudy, which in Scotland it's probably cloudy.
Yeah.
And then number one. California. Woohoo.
The whole state.
It says California, USA. Actually, they're focused more on a highway in California.
Oh.
This spooky area of the U.S. has had more UFO sightings than anywhere else in the country. UFOs are commonly spotted along the Pacific Coast Highway from San Diego to San Francisco. So.
And that underwater UFO base is off the coast of San Diego.
Yeah, you can stop by, check that out, and then keep going down the Pacific Coast Highway. Maybe this is a good time to go visit some friends in California. Although I think my friends only live in San Diego, so there's that.
Well, you could do, you know, it'd be fun maybe next year, hit San Diego Comic-Con, and then drive up the Pacific Coast Highway, check out your friends, maybe go north to San Francisco, see Corey Scott, big fan of the network. Actually, he's sort of part of the network now. Anyways. All right. So great list. Where can people...
Friends of the network.
Yes, friends of the network. Where can people find the rest of this list?
At successfulmeetings.com.
And we'll...
The link...
Yeah, we'll have the link in the show notes to the podcast as well.
Successfulmeetings.com.
So, of all these places, where's...
It's really bizarre, and I've seen other websites do this, too.
Yeah, but you know what? That's pretty smart. It's pretty smart. So, of all these...
It is.
Of all these places...
Most places that I see do that, where it's like...
We keep on talking over each other. It's frustrating.
Well, there's also breaks, and you're kind of lagging right now.
Oh.
For me.
Okay.
A little bit.
Okay.
So it's not me being rude. It's just you're not talking when I start.
Okay. Let me ask you, Anessa.
So ask your question.
Yes.
Dave.
Yes. I'm going to ask it right now. Of all these places, where's the one place that you'd want to check out on this list?
Ooh. I kind of want to go to Wycliffe Well, Australia. For one, I imagine it to be like the Australian version of Roswell, and two, I've always wanted to see the southern skies, so that would kill two birds with one stone.
Let's move on to the second story of the show. Not Human gets release date. And if you want to see a really, really bad-looking movie, then you want to check this. I think this is the one I'm thinking of. It's been 2 weeks since I put this in the document, so it could be not the one I'm thinking of. But back in January 2012, yeah, it is the one. This is not a good-looking movie, but if you like really bad, cheesy movies, then this one is for you. Back in January 2012, details first emerged about the movie Ombis, which then became Ombis Alien Invasion, and is now known as Not Human, and thank God they changed the title because Ombis is not a good movie title. Omnibus, yeah. Omnibus would be a good movie title, but not Ombis. I mean, what the hell is that?
Maybe it's like Ombis. Maybe we're saying it wrong.
Yeah,
Ombis.
Yeah, it's possible. So
I don't know. Either way, like the different spellings, I can't think of anything that would sound any better. So.
No. Okay, so after some false starts, the film is finally arriving on home video. You'll be able to watch the film on video on demand September 9th, which is in 5 days. And that's followed by a DVD release sometime in December. So a big gap between the video on demand and the DVD release. So here's a brief synopsis of Not Human. It's set in the former industrial town of Metzburg. After a meteorite crash lands Glenn, a homeless man, gets too close to the crash site, and as chemical poisons... Okay, hang on 1 second. I wrote this really badly. So Glenn, the homeless guy, gets too close to a crash site as a chemical poison sprays out of the meteorite, enveloping him and begins to turn his insides into a slimy substance. Glenn is discovered by lovebirds Mark and Lucy as the alien infection begins to consume Glenn's body. Shocked by their gruesome discovery, Mark and Lucy contact local sheriff Thomas Brackett, who aids the traumatized couple. The collateral damage begins adding up as the virus begins to overrun the unsuspecting village. Adding to the chaos, a mysterious government team shows up and attempts to keep order while trying to contain the alien plague. Mark, Lucy, and Sheriff Brackett are stuck in the middle of an alien invasion where they must unite while the surviving townsfolk, or with the surviving townsfolk, to take on the ever-growing army of mutated Metzburg residents. So this
dun,
is
dun, dun.
So this is one of those ones where it's not, you never really actually see the alien. It's more of a, like an infection turning the humans into aliens of some kind. So if you click on the link in the show notes of the podcast, you'll see a video, some kind of trailer for the movie, and it looks pretty bad. But like I said before, if you like kind of cheesy, crappy, really low-budget films, then I think you'll like this one.
Cool. I think I might actually give it a watch if it's on Netflix or something. I wouldn't really pay for it otherwise.
So a year from now, that may be your pick.
Very possible.
Or in 3 months. Who knows? I guess we'll find out.
Yeah, it's one of those things, if it's on Netflix and if I'm bored enough and I'm like, oh, that looks awful, I'm in the mood for something that looks awful, then I might watch it. So, and if Brad's around, he might watch it too, but I wouldn't blame him if he said no.
Yeah, I could totally see this as a Netflix movie, definitely.
Yeah, that's the only way that I would watch it. It would have to be on Netflix, Amazon Prime, or Hulu.
Yeah, I'm afraid that that's the way most people will want to watch this, is through those kind of services. I don't really see a lot of people paying money for this movie.
No, but they'd still earn money every time it's played. So
yeah, definitely. And if they have good enough cover art, they may get a few viewers on Netflix, because it's all about the cover art, right? And the description.
Well, yeah, it's like about the cover art and the description. And as long as people don't go to Rotten Tomatoes or IMDb, then they should be good to go.
Yeah, exactly. So look for video on demand for Not Human September 9th. And then in December, it gets a DVD release. All right. Moving on to story number 3. And Brad, this is your story. What do you got?
This is from... IFLScience.com. Their story is, we could find alien life, but politicians don't have the will.
Stupid politicians.
Basically, it's kind of putting forth the thought that if we found alien life, how would government deal with that backlash? So we've discovered thousands of exoplanets. We've just discovered one that's like right next door to the Earth. And by next door, I mean a few, like 4 or 5 light years away, which in the grand, in the galactic scheme of things, that is next door. What if we actually found life? It would be far easier for us to deal with the thought of a sterile universe because it's not going to rock the boat politically. It's not going to rock the boat religiously. Because if we do find life elsewhere, how are we going to reinterpret the Bible? I mean, I'm not talking like microbial life. I think that that could be, oh, okay, well, that's fine. But I think if we came up to discovering intelligent life that is able to actually communicate with us, that means we're no longer special, like it says we are in the Bible. There's a lot of constituents that and people who, you know, give to campaigns that believe in that ideology. How would a political system that is funded partially by those who have strong religious beliefs, how would they deal with a possible imminent collapse of politics as we know it if we do discover life? Is it easier to just kind of sweep that under the rug? What if, and now I'm going to take it a step further, and this isn't even anything to do with the article, but what if we've already discovered it? Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, what if we already discovered it and we just kind of, you know, a bunch of people said, nope, can't deal with that now.
You know, that's not out of the realm of possibility, because that's like a storyline in like fiction, right? Where the government, they've known about alien life for a long time, but they've covered it up for, you know, since 1947. They've known about alien life from the Roswell crash or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's, and this article is also putting forth the thought of, well, maybe NASA and other science programs aren't getting the money because our technology has reached a point where maybe we're like, you know, this close to actually discovering something. So, yeah, I really highly recommend if you check the show notes to check out this article, because it's really something very, very, very sobering to think about. How would the political, and this is geopolitical even, I'm not limiting this to the U.S., but how would politics in general, how would we respond to us actually discovering intelligent life?
You know what? I think I could be wrong about this, but I think there's more people in the world, and the government probably doesn't want to, or politicians don't want to think about this or accept this. But I think there's a lot more people that would be accepting of us discovering there is life out there in the galaxy, in the universe, than they think there is. I think people are a lot more open-minded than politicians think there are.
There's a lot of open-minded people, but there's also a significant amount of closed-minded people. And, I mean, this is seen just about every day with people's religion and their beliefs or feelings towards certain topics. I mean, homosexuality, there's a lot of people out there that are very accepting of it, but there's also other people that are very much against it and don't wish to acknowledge it. And it could potentially be people like that that would not acknowledge the existence of extraterrestrials, because that would go pretty much against their beliefs altogether, because everything that they had learned is not as it is.
That makes me sad.
And
it makes me pissed off thinking about that, the possibility that we already know that there's alien life out there, but the government's covering it up just because some stupid politicians don't want their constituents to actually know about this.
Well, I can kind of see why they would cover it up, because, I mean, if they did find life out there and if they have communicated with it or have done research on it or whatever, regardless of how open-minded we are with the idea of finding extraterrestrials, how many of those people that are open-minded to the idea of finding them will actually keep an open mind once they encounter them one-on-one? Do you think they would still feel the same once they actually see a real life alien, maybe they would actually end up being more terrified or more scared or be like, oh, I never thought that would actually happen. I was just saying it. Like, how many people would actually stick by their belief? And I think that's probably the other thing, too, is they don't want to take a chance on if, indeed, they do have proof of extraterrestrials.
Hmm. I really think that finding out about alien life would actually bring the world together. Like, there's so much strife and war going on. I think, well, maybe it's...
I think what would bring us together would be an alien attack.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking of. That's what.
And I'd rather live in ignorance of UFOs than have aliens actually attack us.
Yeah, because
I mean, sure, it's great if the government's getting prepared just in case. That's fine, but I don't know. Like, I would like for something to bring us together other than war, whether it's war amongst ourselves or war coming from another planet.
Yeah. Sure, it would bring the world together, but you'd have a better chance of dying from an alien invasion than the war going on in the Middle East right now.
Yeah, and I don't know. I think hoping for an alien invasion is probably not the best of ways to bring the world together.
Yeah.
Because you bring the world together, you also destroy a fair chunk of it.
Yeah.
And if for those of you who don't read comics, you know, we're kind of talking about the trade paperback, the comic book version of Watchmen.
Yeah.
Essentially. I mean, I guess I've kind of given away the ending. But if you haven't seen it or haven't read it, that's really how Ozymandias pulls all of it together and brings peace to the Earth, is by telling a tremendous lie that alien life exists and it wants to kill us, and in fact kills millions of people in New York, and that's what he does to bring peace to the Earth by sacrificing millions of lives to make it happen.
Was that in the movie?
The movie version, it's not the psychic squid, but it's in fact Dr. Manhattan. Ozymandias creates a bomb that uses the same type of energy that Dr. Manhattan manipulates or uses for his powers.
Okay.
And the massive amounts of life lost in New York is blamed on him going kind of rogue, losing touch with his humanity, and Dr. Manhattan ends up saying, well, you know, you're not that far off. I'm just going to leave. We've kind of accomplished something pretty good here. Whatever, I'm gone. And that was that.
I couldn't remember how the movie ended. It's been a while.
No.
All right. This seems like a really long story. I think it would be a good read if you're interested. IFLScience.com will have the link in the show notes as well. Anything you want to add to this before we move on?
Mm-mm. No.
Okay. All right. Well, before we get into the craft corner, let's talk about ways that people can get a hold of us, reach out and touch us in a non-actual physical way, but, you know, email and voicemail, galacticnetcasts@gmail.com. That's our email address, galacticnetcasts@gmail.com, or call our voicemail number, 805-328-3966, 805-328-3966. And I totally just remembered we had a great email from somebody, and I didn't paste it into the show notes, so maybe I'll do that while one of you guys is talking.
Sweet.
I sent that email along to you guys. Did you guys get it?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we got it, and we read it, and we were like, wow.
Okay. It's long. It's really long.
It's long, but it's really good, and I think it's really sweet, and I really appreciate the email and the feedback.
Yeah, well, so if you want to give us feedback like that person did, galacticnetcasts@gmail.com. All right, let's move on to the next feature, which is this right here.
Please identify the craft you witnessed.
A black, triangular, three-dimensional shape, huge, just flying, hovering in it.
Shaped like almost like between an egg and like a teardrop.
Two long cylinder objects flying over me.
This is a zone. I can see the occupants in it.
It appeared to be rotating, and it was almost circular to disc shape, and it hovered for maybe about 5 minutes.
That, my friends, is the intro for the Craft Corner. We focus on a different type of alien spacecraft every week on the show. Could be something from our world here, you know, like flying saucers, or something from the fictional world, and I believe that's what we're covering this week. Brad, what do you got for us?
Well, we actually did a little bit of talking about this in our other show, which is the Sci-Fi Geeks Club. We had a great discussion with the gentleman from the UK. But one of the stories that we talked about mentioned Harrison Ford. And if you speak Harrison Ford and you're talking about a craft corner, you're probably talking about the Millennium Falcon.
Of course.
The YT-1300 light freighter, which is the actual model of the ship.
That's the nomenclature?
Yes. the Millennium Falcon is a fictional spacecraft from the Star Wars universe, commanded by smuggler Han Solo and his Wookiee first mate Chewbacca. The highly modified YT-1300 light freighter first appeared in the Star Wars A New Hope film in 1977. And it's going to return again with the new series of films. So looking forward to that. According to George Lucas, though, the Millennium Falcon's design was inspired by a hamburger.
So not a falcon.
No.
Damn it.
No, and check this, though. It's inspired by a hamburger with the cockpit being an olive on its side. So if you think about a hamburger put on a plate, and then this olive that might have been impaled by a toothpick and shoved into the top of the burger, instead of doing that, you just put the olive off to the side of this burger, and that's how he got the kind of the vision of the, at least the shape of what the Millennium Falcon should look like. The original ship that he had that they were going to do was a more elongated ship. Now, we've talked about Space 1999 before, and the ships in that were, gosh, they almost look like, as I recall it, kind of rounded off cornered boxes that were kind of laid end to end to make some kind of a longer rectangular ship with sort of supports structure of beams around them, and then a sort of triangle is not quite, but like an elongated triangle is sort of the nose of the ship.
Yeah, and that think of that one helicopter that you've seen before, I'm sure, that is the heavy lift helicopter.
Yep.
And that's pretty much what what was the name of those ships from Space 1999? The Eagle from Space 1999. It's kind of like, it's two separate parts. It's the front nose section, which is like the cockpit and the crew area. Then there's the back section, which is kind of like they can take that off, and that goes into their base, and they keep the rest of the ship on the surface of the moon, sort of. I'm kind of giving a bad description of it. But anyways, go ahead, Brad. Sorry.
Anyways, let's see. The original model that they were thinking about using for the Millennium Falcon, they actually modified it, rescaled it, and that became Princess Leia's ship, the Tantive IV. So there you go. The sound of the ship traveling through hyperspace comes from two tracks of the engine noise of a McDonnell Douglas DC-9. And by tracks, we're saying if you were to look at like an 8-track tape, each track is its own unique thing, but they can all be played at the same time. So think of it that way. So two tracks are an engine from a DC-9. One of these tracks is a slightly out of sync with the other to introduce a phasing effect. So, and maybe you could talk about this a little bit more, Dave, but essentially there's a third track now that sounds like the other two airplanes, but that's off just a little bit to make it sound a little echoey and a little weird.
I love sound design. I love the origins of famous sounds from science fiction, you know? And I think we talked about that, not on this show, but on the Sci-Fi Geeks Club, famous origins of, iconic science fiction noises or things from science fiction. And this is,
yep.
I love that kind of stuff.
Absolutely. And now the last piece of this puzzle is they recorded the hum of the cooling fans on the motion control rig at Industrial Light and Magic. Now, these motion control rigs that they were talking about, when they do this scene at the end of A New Hope where they're taking out the Death Star, they had actually taken bits of models and put them all together and made a put them on a flat board. And then they had made these motion control rigs, which essentially was a computer-controlled camera mount that could be programmed to fly over, essentially give the illusion of flying over this thing to do a repetitive motion the exact same way, the same time, each time. So this was kind of a revolutionary thing. So you can imagine a piece of equipment, computer controlled, built in the 70s. That cooling fan was probably really freaking huge and obviously very loud. So they were able to record that as a whole nother track, put all these tracks together, and that's how you got the sound of the Millennium Falcon hitting hyperdrive and going into hyperspace. So one other thing from this article is that Joss Whedon kind of credits the Millennium Falcon as being one of the two primary inspirations for his Firefly ship named Serenity. From the television show. It was the Falcon and the Falcon's distinct shape that appears in, the Falcon and the Falcon's distinct shape appear in Star Trek First Contact, Blade Runner, Spaceballs, and Starship Troopers.
Yeah, I remember seeing like a screenshot of Star Trek. What'd you say? Which one?
Star Trek First Contact.
First Contact, I think. Oh, I thought it was Into Darkness. Swear to God, I saw some Star Wars thingy in the Darkness. I don't know.
Yeah, actually, you know, I think I heard about that too.
Yeah, that's funny how it appears. They just throw it in. That's awesome. You know that. So there was no doubt that the Millennium Falcon would be in Episode 7, since Joss Whedon was so. What am I thinking? It's not Joss Whedon doing that. It's J.J.
Abrams.
Never mind. Yep. Back up the bus. Rewind. All right. I never said that.
So I'm not laughing at you, Dave. I'm laughing near you. It's completely different.
Okay. I'm not pointing at you, Dave, and laughing.
Pointing slightly off to the right and laughing.
Yeah.
Now, the manga series Berserk includes a Millennium Falcon arc. Now, I've never heard of Berserk, but if you're a manga fan, you might be able to check that out. And in the series, the anime manga series Hellsing, the Millennium Falcon is referenced briefly for comedic effect. So it's an iconic ship that has had impact in a number of different ways, is revered as a highly recognizable ship. If you were to hold an image of that ship up to somebody, they'd be able to tell you the movie it was in or the name of the ship.
Definitely.
Guaranteed.
Yeah. I remember seeing the trailer for Star Wars Episode 4, A New Hope, for the very first time as a very young Dave. And one of the scenes that really got my juices going was the scene where they were escaping the Death Star and they have fend off the TIE fighters. With Han in the one gun turret, and then Luke in the other one. That was one of I was so jazzed. I was so pumped from just that scene alone on the Millennium Falcon. I hope they do hope they involve the gun turrets in some way in Episode 7. That would be pretty cool.
Sure.
All right.
So yeah, there you go. Our craft corner ship is the Millennium Falcon. There you go.
All right. Thank you, Brad. Normally, we would do separate picks. Each of us would be watching something or reading something or playing something or whatever, something that has to do with aliens. But we decided a couple weeks ago that we would do a joint pick because we're all Doctor Who fans, and the new series, the new season of Doctor Who, featuring the brand new Doctor, played by Peter Capaldi, debuted. And we've had two episodes since we decided to do this as our joint pick. Deep Breath, the Series 8 premiere, and the second episode, Into the Dalek. And this is our joint pick for this week. So who wants to start?
Doesn't matter.
Anyone?
I think Dave would like to start.
Okay. Well, I don't know where to start. I was really happy with both episodes. We had a big discussion on this on the latest episode of the Sci-Fi Geeks Club. So if you want even more talk on these episodes, check out that podcast. We're on iTunes and Stitcher, and we had a great discussion with Daryl, our guest geek from the UK, and he had a very interesting UK perspective. But my perspective is, and we touched on this on the Sci-Fi Geeks Club, that Deep Breath was a flawed episode, but it got us a good start for the new Doctor. I thought it was, and it was also very Clara heavy. What's your last name?
Well, in Oswald.
Clara Oswald.
But no, it just depends if you're American or British. It's Clara over here. It's Clara over there. So.
Okay.
Tomato.
Okay. But the episode begins. Deep Breath begins with it's set back in 18. What year do you think that is? What's that?
I just said Victorian era. I don't know what year it was.
Okay. I'm going to say 1880. How about that? Will that work?
Fair assessment.
Or sure. Do you think it was earlier than that? I think it was like 1840 or something like that.
Could have been.
Okay. It doesn't matter. Victorian age England. We're back with Strax. What are the other two? Strax and... help me out here.
Lady Vastra.
Yes.
Lady Vastra. I couldn't remember her name. For some reason, I kept thinking Vespa, and I'm like, no, that's a scooter.
It's totally a scooter.
Yeah, it is a scooter.
And so I'm like, I'm just going to be quiet.
So it's them, and a dinosaur appears out of nowhere. And we're like, there's not supposed to be dinosaurs in 1800s England. What the hell's going on? And then the dinosaur coughs up the TARDIS, and that's where we start. So who wants to take it from there?
Are we talking about what the episode is about?
Well, we could. I mean, we could go anywhere with this. We can go in any direction.
I mean, like, I don't know if it's just like an opinion piece or what it's about. Either way, if you've not seen the episode yet and you don't want it ruined for you, you should probably tune out.
Yes. We give you permission to stop the episode if you don't want to be spoiled.
Because so far what we've said isn't really spoilers, but no. It could get spoily.
No. What I would like to know is how the hell did the dinosaur get in the time matrix or whatever to actually for that stuff to happen? They don't really cover that too much.
I think just aside from TV magic, I think that if there is anything attached to the TARDIS, like has contact probably all around, it will take it with them. And because the dinosaur was attached all around, especially if it's like a living being, I mean, would you really want to time travel and then show up in Victorian England with a T-Rex esophagus?
That's true.
That would be pretty gross.
But
so I think they kind of had to.
But think about this, though. The TARDIS is sitting in places when it takes off usually, right? When it dematerializes and goes to wherever it goes. So why doesn't the floor around that come with it? Because it's touching, right? So why doesn't that work that way?
Well, I think the thing is it's all encompassing. I mean, it's completely surrounded by a living being. And I think the TARDIS can differentiate between being stuck inside a ship or sitting on the street corner versus an organic being. I think once you factor in the organic being, it's just going to say, well, fine, let's go. Because we know that the TARDIS is intelligent. We know that it has a consciousness. And I think it's able to differentiate between asphalt and a living being. And you're not going to transport with just part of it. Or you're not, you know, you don't really want to harm what's around you. And it could potentially harm the dinosaur. So rather than letting it die, it's going to take it with.
Good point.
So
you've educated us tonight, Anessa. Thank you very much for that.
That's my guess. Also, TV magic works.
So, okay, the TARDIS appears, it crashes or whatever, it lands, and the Doctor and Clara get out, and we go from there. So what was you guys' favorite part of Deep Breath, the season premiere?
I think my favorite part was actually when the Doctor's portion really started taking off. And up until that, it was fairly Clara heavy, and then it kind of focuses on the Doctor a bit. And then it finishes up with Clara, so it's a very Clara-centric episode. And I just felt like at the beginning, one, Capaldi was trying to find his groove, in my opinion. And two, they really focused on Clara and her opinion of the Doctor and her reaction to his appearance being old. And the newer generation of Whovians have primarily seen just younger Doctors. I mean, even Eccleston, from Eccleston they started getting younger, and then you go back and you have someone that's the same age as Hartnell, the first Doctor, and they're unfamiliar with the old Doctor. And so it really focused on his age, and it was when they started not focusing on his age and when he was actually getting out there and, like, trying to figure out how to escape from these living robotic things that he really started to shine, I think. But that was, yeah, I kind of lost my train of thought. But yeah, like, that's, to me, when Capaldi started finding his rhythm, I think it was, he was off to a rough start. He was new. He was figuring out, like, how he was going to be. And as with every Doctor in their regeneration, you kind of have to figure out who you are and how you're going to play the part of the Doctor. And I think he had an idea of how he wanted to play the Doctor. It was just a matter of figuring out how to get it out there and finding his rhythm and just progressing from there. And I think from the first episode to the second episode, like, he really started to find his groove, and I really enjoyed the second episode a lot more than the first one. But I still enjoy the first one quite a bit, too.
They didn't.
I just thought it was really heavy on Clara and the age thing.
Number 11, Matt Smith, they didn't really show him in that whole sleeping thing, like with Tennant, right? Tennant slept for a while after he first regenerated. Now they did with Capaldi. He was kind of out of it.
They did kind of with Capaldi, but Tennant just slept. I mean, Capaldi couldn't sleep.
Okay. Oh,
that's right.
They kept
trying to get him to go to bed, and he wouldn't sleep.
Okay, that's what it was.
They still brought up sleep, but it was like the complete opposite. Because, I mean, Tennant just slept.
Yeah.
And they're like, we got to go. And he's like, I'm so tired.
Yeah, Capaldi was no good for anything. I could see why they wanted him
Capaldi
to sleep.
Capaldi was like, I haven't slept in days. Like, I totally can't function as, well, I'd say as a human being, but as a Time Lord. Like, because, you know, you get to that point where you're just kind of loopy and out there from sleep deprivation, and that was kind of his state. And they tried to get him to sleep to try to come out of that. And he slept for a bit, but his issue was he really couldn't sleep, and if he fell asleep, it wouldn't be a restful sleep, and it wouldn't be for very long.
Yeah, okay. I was kind of half watching it, half dealing with my surroundings at the time, so I'm going to have to rewatch that episode again just to get more out of it, because I even forget how he got his clothes, how he figured out what to wear. Who do you guys want to talk about that? I forget exactly. What? Where did he get his clothes? I forget.
Well, he got the coat off
and he came back.
What's that?
Yeah, well, he was in an alleyway trying to figure out if he had seen his face before, and he asked some homeless guy if he had seen his face. And I think he ends up getting the guy's coat for a while, and then he just kind of wanders off and ends up with clothes. He's like, I bought this. She's like, well, you got no money. And he's like, oh, well, whatever.
Then there's a joke about the scarf.
Are you talking his final outfit with the black with the red lining?
Yeah. That.
Okay. Well, he, at the end of the adventure, he hops into the TARDIS and takes off without Clara, and then comes back for Clara, and all of a sudden he has these clothes.
Okay, that's right. Okay. All right. Thanks for clarifying that. But there was a joke in the alleyway with the scarf, right? He talks about the scarf and it looking silly or something like that, isn't?
Yeah, he kind of makes fun of the scarf, and in reference, he does a bit of referencing back to previous Doctors or the previous TARDIS, and he's like, because Clara points out, she's like, oh, you've redone the TARDIS, I hate it. He's like, yeah, I really feel that, you know, it needs more circle things. My old TARDIS had circle things. This one needs more circles. Need more circles. And so he had some circles on the wall. And, you know, the original TARDIS had a bunch of circles on the wall.
Yeah, that's
that were illuminated. And so that was kind of a nod to the previous TARDIS and Doctor Who's.
It's a nod to that, and it's also recycled from the 50th anniversary episode, too, because they make a joke about that as well.
Yeah. And I think they're really trying to acknowledge where they've come from over the years and hopefully spark some interest in previous generations of Doctor Who and mm-hmm. try to let people know that, hey, there's more than Doctor Who pre-2005.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there's a lot of new people watching Doctor Who that aren't aware that it's been around for as long as it has because maybe they've only ever caught it on Netflix.
Yeah. And even like it, even when it comes down to the theme song sounds more classic Doctor Who as well. You hear that bass, which hasn't been as prominent in the last few incarnations of the theme song. And
yeah, the last few incarnations, especially the last one, they really used orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of orchestral music. And this one's kind of gone back to being a simple Doctor Who sound theme.
What do you guys think of the graphics? That was actually created by a fan. Did you hear about that?
Yeah, it was a fan that had created a trailer, like their own version of what the intro could be. And I believe it was Moffat that was like, hey, I really dig that. Can we do that? And they got the guy's permission. And then he, you know, talked to his graphics. People were like, I want that. Make that happen sort of thing. And that's what they did. But yeah, they got it from a fan who was really good with, you know, really creative and really, really good at what they did. And it looks professionally done if you actually go out and look up the YouTube video for the fan produced intro.
They've tweaked it a little bit for the show, but it's pretty much got the spirit of the original.
And the cool thing about it, and as Moffat was saying, that the intros have been about the TARDIS in space, but not really relating to time, and that they really wanted to focus on that a little bit more, and that's what the intro is really kind of really trying to illustrate more of, hey, this is time travel. Let's show that.
Yeah, they show space
at
the end.
Let's show a clock. Let's show the inner workings of a clock, and let's show, like, traveling through these gears. It's representing, you know, traveling through time.
Yeah.
So.
All right, let's move on to, unless Brad, you never answered the question, what was your favorite part of the premiere episode, the season premiere?
Wow. You know, I think my favorite part is, and some people have really kind of talked about how it went on a little too long, but I think addressing the use of dialogue between two characters, which is actually the dialogue between the show and the viewer.
Mm-hmm.
In the scene in the alley where he's talking to the bum, the homeless guy in the alley, the conversation is, you know, I'm not sure I know who I am, which is kind of standard fare for, you know, a regeneration, but also he asks the question, have you seen this face before? Now, we know that, and it's not uncommon for an actor to appear on Doctor Who and appear maybe in multiple episodes or appear as the Doctor. There was an episode where Colin Baker, who became the sixth Doctor, who actually his first appearance was a guard on Gallifrey.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually see him for a little bit.
I know where you're going with
and
this.
So now we fast forward to the Tennant era where Peter Capaldi has shown up in the episode of The Fires of Pompeii, which oddly enough is the first appearance of Karen Gillan, who ends up showing up as Amy Pond, as Matt Smith's main companion for his run. And Also, Peter Capaldi shows up in an episode of, oh my God, Torchwood.
Torchwood, yeah.
So the interesting thing is Moffat had a discussion with Russell T. Davies, who is the showrunner. He brought it back in 2005. And the two of them got talking, and Russell T. Davies said, hey, if you ever run into this, I've got an idea. I know how this could work, and it would be very interesting. And when they made the choice to have Peter Capaldi be the doctor, Moffat said, okay, here's the deal. What's your take on it? And so we're going to learn why this face that we've seen before is now the doctor's face, and it's going to be supposed to be something very interesting and universe shattering. So
cool.
And I think it will also address the end of the 50th anniversary episode where Matt Smith is speaking with Tom Baker.
Mm-hmm.
And the character that Tom Baker is playing is heavily alluded to, even though he's called the curator, that he is the doctor, a future version of the doctor, but the doctor nonetheless. And he states, you know, Tom Baker says, you know, I revisit a few of them, of my favorites, I think is the line that he says. So I think that we're going to – the seeds had already been sown, and now we're going to reap the benefits of Russell T. Davies' idea. And we, I think that's going to be really cool.
And we might see Russell T. Davies on the credits again. That'd be cool too.
Yeah, it would be. It would be cool.
Yeah. So, yeah.
But the other thing is the dialogue in the
– Brad, go ahead.
The other part is the dialogue for between Clara and Lady Vastra. So – I think that's very interesting where they discuss, yeah, he's old, get over it. I mean, is the essential bit of the conversation, and that's the showrunners trying to deal with, I think, a lot of fear that probably the BBC had of, they've had young, attractive male leads play the doctor for the past, you know, number of years, 6 years, 7 years. Now, are they going to lose a bit of the fan base? And I think that they needed to address that. That had to be the elephant in the room that everybody – that they had to point to and let everybody know that, yeah, okay, we get it. But don't be a jerk.
Yeah.
He's still the doctor, no matter what he looks like. No,
exactly. And here's why you need to stick around.
Yeah.
And they made the doctor very mysterious. I think the exchange that they really needed to make, and I think they did very well, is they traded the youth and the energy for the older age and the mystery and the wisdom. Mm-hmm. And I think that was a very shrewd change that they've made in the writing that I think is going to keep people around. Or, well, maybe you'll lose some of the more quote-unquote fair-weather fans, and you'll get a new group of people that'll be interested in something a little bit different that the doctor finally has to offer, being an older male lead.
I noticed something that, along with Peter Capaldi being a different – playing the doctor differently, they've changed the way they film the episodes too. It's a lot – it's slower, and they're using different camera angles too, and I noticed on the second episode, Into the Dalek, that they're using handheld cameras, which I've never noticed before on an episode of Doctor Who. Like, kind of shaky cam, in-your-face sort of cameras, which that's the kind of stuff that I notice.
Sure.
So do you want to – let's make that our gateway into the second episode, which we want to talk about tonight, which is Into the Dalek, which aired last Saturday, our time, from where we are now. What'd you guys think of that one?
I really enjoyed it. I think once Capaldi kind of found his groove in the first episode, it really carried over to the second episode. There's, and I mentioned this in the other podcast, but Capaldi seems to have a bit of a issue with his moral compass, and it starts to kind of like peek its head out in the first episode. There's a scene where he's fighting with this clockwork guy, and they're in this hot air balloon, and you don't really know what happened, but it's implied that it's possible that the doctor pushed the guy out to his death, or he could have fallen out, and we don't really know. But in the next episode, Into the Dalek, you've got the Doctor and Clara and a couple of other people, soldiers that are miniaturized, and they go into the Dalek because they're trying to fix this Dalek, quote, fix it, because it's a, quote, good Dalek at this point. And the Dalek has a defense system and basically antibodies, and anytime that you end up with a foreign object in your body, whether it's a germ, virus, whatever, these antibodies are going to attack, and that's essentially what these do. And Capaldi gives this guy a pill, and he says, here, take this. And the guy's like, okay, what's it supposed to do? And basically it attracts the antibodies to him, because it kind of, I guess, like radiates stuff where it's easier for them to find him as the threat, so that way they can get away. And they're like, oh, what'd you do that for? He's like, he was dead anyway. And previous doctors would have tried to have saved the person, at least the past couple of doctors, they would have done a bit more. So there's a little maybe offset with his moral compass. It's really hard to tell. It's kind of iffy. And I know there was an episode with Tennant where he just kind of gave up. He's like, I'm not going to do this anymore. Figure it out yourself, sort of thing. And it ended up backfiring on him. And I mean, to some extent, Eccleston kind of had that issue too when it came to the Daleks, but his was more anger, but he still, for the most part, tried to do the right thing. But yeah, like, some of the other doctors might have tried to get a, you know, save the guy, or at least said, sorry, I can't save you.
Well, that was sort of an issue that was brought up by the doctor himself, asking Clara if he was a good person. Clara didn't know, couldn't tell him if he was a good person or not. So maybe he's wrestling with that, you know?
Yeah, he doesn't know either. He doesn't know who he is. He doesn't know if he's a good person or a bad person, and it could just be things from his previous incarnations are starting to come up, and he's uncertain about who he is as a being, if he's a good person. So
I was really hoping that the doctor would let that soldier, I don't know her name, but I do know I know her from another show that I've watched, another British show about these college kids living in a house. I forget the name of it right now. Fresh Meat, I believe, is the name of the show. And she's on that. She was the person that was in the ship in the very first scene, and she asked the doctor if she could go with him. And I was really hoping that he would say yes, and he didn't, which is really weird, because normally he's like, yeah, come on with me. So that's another kind of difference in this doctor.
I don't know, but I think he basically states he's done with soldiers. He's done his
right.
bit, you know, at the Battle of Trenzalore, which went for hundreds of years. I think he was just done.
Okay.
He wasn't going to do that.
That's why I forgot why he said no.
And that was my kind of feeling. So yeah, there you go.
Brad, was your,
he's very, go ahead.
I was going to say, what was your favorite part of this, Into the Dalek episode?
Right now, I'm having a little bit of trouble with the grade morals. I think the points where the episode, when I say I have trouble with it, it's not that I don't like it. It's I'm concerned, you know. I mentioned this in the Sci-Fi Geeks Club, that I don't like Colin Baker as a doctor. I did not enjoy him because, at least at the point where he only got, you know, a season, and maybe they would have straightened things out. But to me, he was more vain, more greedy, more of the negative things of what you kind of think the doctor is, while being a little bit eccentric. They played down the being the eccentric, which they kind of had to because Tom Baker played that part so well. But they played up the more negative aspects of who he was, and I could not get behind Colin Baker as a doctor. So now we're getting to Peter Capaldi, and his version of the doctor is eccentric, is, I don't want to say morally bankrupt, because that's way negative, but he is trying to figure out who he is and where his moral compass is going to end up. And that's really kind of the feeling that we're getting right now. And it just, it feels like it's riding close to that line where it could swing either way. And at the points where it swings the opposite way, he swings it back. So it's just this dangerous game of going back and forth between being likable and unlikable. And I hate to see it swing totally the other way and make him a doctor that I don't care for. But right now, and the reason why I'm even bringing this up is at the beginning where they get miniaturized. You know, Clara says to him, you know, is that true? Would you actually kind of explode if you don't keep breathing while you're being miniaturized? And he's like, pop. You know, he sort of
don't
illustrates
be
it.
Yeah.
So he makes light of something that is, you know, kind of morbid. But that fun, that sense of humor is still there. And that was really kind of good and reassuring. You know, I guess in the grand scheme of things, I don't care what the doctor looks like, if he's old, if he's young, whatever, it doesn't matter. But there needs to still be that sense of fun, that sense of that feeling that he's still going to be there to do the right thing. That needs to be there, and I never really felt that with Colin Baker. So
yeah, I don't think they're going to tip Peter Capaldi negatively.
I don't think that, and they can't. They really can't, because the way they've structured their response to the fans is, hey, here's all these likable things about this new guy, to like suddenly pull that rug out from underneath everything. They would make him completely unlikable, and I don't think I really think that the BBC is probably cognizant of having a reoccurrence of a Colin Baker scenario.
Yeah.
I don't think they call it the Colin Baker scenario, but I think that they probably, that somebody does somewhere.
Yeah.
And I don't think that they would do that, because that would, you've taken away too many of the things that makes the doctor as we know him.
Okay. Before we move on and wrap up our picks for the week, let's touch on a couple of things. Let's touch on Clara's new man in her life. They're not really dating, but they're about to go on a date. How do you guys feel about, it's a soldier with PTSD entering the scene. How do you guys feel about this guy?
I think I can see headbutting going on with the doctor and Clara and her relationship with the guy that's a soldier with PTSD.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing.
But I'm really hoping that that's not like a big thing. If it's a couple of times throughout the season, that would be fine. But if it starts to become more of a thing in episodes, then I'm not really going to dig it.
Well, maybe they do this. Maybe they talk about the PTSD, because maybe the doctor has it too, because he was at war for hundreds of years, right? So maybe.
Yeah, and it's very possible that maybe he can find a person that's a soldier that's gone through something similar, not for as long, but a similar experience and a similar inner battle with who they are post-war.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that the way Christopher Eccleston's doctor was, he definitely had PTSD. You know, he really, dealing with the end of the Time War and everything there, he was, from the descriptions and from what little I know of PTSD and the couple of people that I do know that are affected by that, it really, you kind of get the sense of that's already been there. And he's had a couple of regenerations to sort of deal with that, but now he's gone through Trenzalore and he's kind of gone through it again. So, yeah, it's going to be – he's lost a lot, that's for sure.
So where do you think this whole miniaturized into the Dalek, because we know where Clara came – or we know what episode – or how Clara was introduced to Doctor Who. She was – spoiler alert, she was miniaturized – inside a Dalek, right? Mm-hmm. So do you think that's related somehow?
Was she miniaturized? I thought it was just her consciousness.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah.
That was in the Dalek.
Okay, maybe.
They had mentioned that they were able to convert other life forms into a Dalek. So they were able to actually distill a person and make them into the sort of organic component of a Dalek and put them into a Dalek body.
Okay. So maybe it's related somehow. But not directly, I guess. We'll see.
Maybe, or they just want us to think.
Yeah.
And it's totally not related at all.
Yes. Moffat. he likes doing that kind of stuff. All right, so we're running a little bit long. I think we've talked about Doctor Who enough. We've covered all the bases. Are we hopeful for the new Doctor in the new season? I mean, do you?
Yes.
Okay, all right. Sounds good. All right, so before we get out of here, we had some feedback. We mentioned the email address earlier, galacticnetcasts@gmail.com. Got a great email this week from one of our listeners, and I'm going to read. I'm going to try to skim it here. It's pretty long, so bear with me. It says, hello. I've been listening to your podcast for about a week now. Started from earlier episodes and I'm now up to episode 65. 65? You got a lot of episodes yet to go. He's not going to be hearing this for a while.
If he's gotten a ways in a week, he probably does a lot of driving and working and stuff. So
yeah, good point. Okay. And haven't been able to listen to anything else. Wow, we're that good. I wanted to catch up to the most recent podcast before I dropped a line, but I couldn't resist any longer. I live in Kenai, Alaska, about an hour and a half from Homer, where Anessa visited a while back. I am a sanitation engineer. Ha ha, janitor, he says. And work 10 hours a day, 6 days a week, and needed something to help the hours go by and stumbled across your show by dumb luck. I have a burning question, sci-fi related, of course, and hoped you could help me out. There were a few podcasts where you guys spoke of Prometheus, an alien, and discuss their relationship. Having watched both movies years and years apart, I felt it necessary to rent them both. After watching them, I was riddled with excitement that I was able to point out similarities that would have otherwise gone unnoticed, but one thing struck me as obviously inconsistent. In Alien, when they board the space jockey ship, the space jockey is sitting at the helm with his ribs cracked outwards, where an alien was presumably birthed. At the end of Prometheus, an alien did burst out of the space jockey's chest, but it was on the Nostromos escape pod. It was my understanding that he was the last engineer on the planet. Was this a mistake, or am I missing something? Thoughts, guys?
I'm going to have to go back and rewatch the movies again.
Yeah.
There was a lot of inconsistencies in Prometheus.
Yeah, and a lot of it was the way that it was edited. As mentioned before in probably the other podcast, we talked about basically how the version that's out on Blu-ray, the director's cut, is the way to go because the story makes a lot more sense. There's a lot less gaps. And so knowing this, I would be more inclined to actually give Prometheus another watch because, yeah, I really felt that the storyline was kind of lacking. There were gaps. You kind of wonder, why would this geographer that has these things that can map the tunnel, like, why would he do something so stupid? How could they get lost? I mean, well, I say, how could a geographer get lost? But a van full of geographers got lost in the UK.
Oh, man. Okay.
I'm pretty sure my professor couldn't find his way out of a paper bag, and someone thought that it would be a great idea to go through Bristol as a shortcut. We ended up right back on the highway that we started out on, but we did get to see Bristol.
Bonus.
Bonus. The other van did not, although they got to their destination like a half hour to an hour sooner, so whatever. We were on an adventure. We were not lost. But anyway, but still, like, just some of the decisions that some of the characters made, it didn't really make sense. And from what I've heard, watching the extended version, their logic and what happens seems to make a bit more sense. And basically, the version that was out in the movie theater was put together that way, just more for looks rather than story.
Okay. So the lesson learned here is to watch it again. But with the director's cut.
The lesson here is to wait until these movies come out on DVD with the extended cut and then just watch that.
Okay. All right.
Instead of having to watch it twice. But no, I do want to check out the movies again, both of them, and see if there is indeed something that PJ might be missing or that we might be missing. Or maybe the movie's what missing it. It's really hard to say, but I would like to give these a watch again just to compare.
I'm really curious to actually do my research now and kind of dig into this. I'm sure somebody has researched this and has wrote about it on the internet. I'm just guessing. I'm just spitballing that's a possibility. Who knows?
Yeah, people write about stuff on the internet all the time. It's like, man, I wonder blah, blah, blah. And it's like you type it in and there's like 100 other people that ask the same question. And yep. It's kind of nice.
Yep. All right, so moving forward with this email, he says, I have a couple of suggestions for movies for you guys. Forgive me if you've discussed them already. I'm still catching up. Number one is They Live. I believe we've talked about that before on the show, right?
We have, and it stars Rowdy Roddy Piper. He would be one of the themes in the wrestler themed restaurant that I would want to open.
Yes. What was it?
It was like Rowdy Roddy Pepper or something.
Oh, okay. All right.
Something to do with a pepper.
Okay.
But yeah, anyway.
Okay,
onward.
Another movie, Mac and Me. I'm not familiar with it. I believe from the cover, it looks familiar. It's a guy with an alien on his head. Not actually coming out of his head.
Those movies that I've seen at the video store, just never like actually picked up.
Oh, the video store.
Yeah, I used to ride my bicycle down to like this tiny little video store and rent videos as a kid.
All right.
It was out in the country, it was okay.
And the final suggestion is The Abyss. Is that Aliens? I forget.
Yes.
Okay.
It is.
All right.
I don't think I've...
No, at the end of it, well, if you see the director's cut, the alien ship, I think, comes up.
Okay.
When Ed Harris, like, snips the wire for the nuclear bomb that's been dropped, he gets a chance to see this whole ship, this sort of underground-looking city, which is actually or underwater city, which is actually a ship. So, yeah, it is definitely Aliens.
Okay.
Yeah, I've seen, I think, a couple of bits and pieces, but I've not actually seen it all the way through. So I'm going to have to give that a watch.
Yeah, maybe one of us should watch it and have it as a pick. That would be a good idea. All right, yep. So he says, the above movies stick out in my brain for one reason or another and would love to hear your take on them. I am sorry for Mac and Me. Had to just throw that in there. All right.
It looks incredibly cheesy and potentially horrible.
This is where
give it a watch.
This is where PJ gets pretty cool. Well, he's been cool the whole time, but
I'm like, he's been cool.
Yeah, he gets personal here. Anessa, sorry if I wrecked the spelling of your name.
Actually, he spelled it right.
Yeah.
So kudos, PJ.
All right, good job, man. If you haven't already, you should check out Invader Zim. It's one of my favorite animated series, drawn by Johan Vasquez, oddly enough, produced by Nickelodeon. I'm not familiar. Are you familiar with this?
Yes.
I've seen the characters. I'm familiar with what they look like, and I know a couple of the characters. I've never actually seen the cartoon. I've always wanted to, though. It looks like something that would be up my alley.
All right, there you go. Thanks, PJ. I think you're the most relatable of the bunch. Based strictly on your outlook on topics and your sense of humor, you are obviously well-read, hardly stumped, and your picks, recommendations are always on point. So good job, Anessa.
It's all my ball jokes. It's cool.
Brad, and he goes on, Brad, I really enjoy your analytical perspective on everything, whether it's scientific, pop culture, or even the most random of topics. You state your opinion and back it to the best of your abilities. Also, I think you should just tell Anessa how you feel and move on. Ha ha.
Well.
Spoiler alert.
Spoilers. Together, so surprise.
Spoilers.
Yeah, I never thought about that. That's a really interesting thing for a listener to follow the history of you guys, you know, because you started out as just co-hosts.
We were just co-hosts.
Yeah.
And it was like a year of talking, and then we're like, hey, baby.
Yeah. And then the rest is history.
Yep.
And finally, he says, and Dave, your ability to narrate is phenomenal. 90% of the time, I forget you're reading something. I have noticed, however, that you tend to get tripped up sometimes. And he said, he put a link in the email, and he says, I think this may help. and it's Will Ferrell from Anchorman doing his warm-up thing. Have you guys seen that?
That's awesome. I think the only times that you really get tripped up are with really weird names.
Yeah, and sometimes I kind of get ahead of myself when I'm reading something. So I understand where you're coming from completely. So he says, keep up the good work and thank you for keeping me company throughout the day, not to mention providing me with movies, short stories, news articles, etc. I do have a favor, though. After you've read your picks, would you mind restating what they were again? We just recently actually, within probably the last 20 or so episodes, started doing that. So, but thank you for the suggestion. Catching up with your shows, I can't always go to your portal of phenomenal picks pertaining to persons of planetary progress, phasers, probes, and other particular topics. PJ. Asta, he says.
Thanks, PJ.
Hasta la pasta.
That was the best email I think we've ever gotten, and the longest email I think we've ever gotten. But thank you very much, PJ. That was awesome.
Yeah, it was really awesome, and we really appreciate the feedback.
Yeah.
Heck yeah.
So. It's always great hearing from our listeners and viewers. So thank you, PJ.
Made my day.
All right. We are coming up on probably the longest episode of this podcast. So let's wrap her up. Don't forget, you can subscribe to us by going to iTunes. We're also on Stitcher. Just search for the Alien Invasion Podcast. Go to our website, galacticnetcast.com, for everything else. Subscription links, our social links on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+. Plus, of course, a way to reach out to us. And you may notice on the website also, we have one of the new tabs is called Else Nerd Shows. And we have teamed up with the guys at the Else Nerds Network. They do two shows on YouTube. What Else Is On? A show about TV, just plain TV. And the other one is Else Nerds 616. Is that correct, Brad?
Yep.
And that's all about comics. We've known these guys for a while now. We've had them on our podcasts once in a while. I believe Sci-Fi Geeks Club. And we had Corey Scott on. Did he guest on the Alien Invasion, or was that on another show? I forget.
No, wait. It was Alien Invasion.
Okay, yeah. So
I wasn't on it.
Okay, yeah. He filled in for you. So we've known these guys, Corey and Gregor, for a while. And I thought, let's just team up with them, a very casual relationship. We'll promote each other's shows, maybe have each of us, you know, guest on one of the other shows once in a while as well. And who knows where else it'll go. We'll take it. So stay tuned and please support Else Nerd Shows. Their presence is at youtube.com/ElseNerdsShow, or just go to Galactic Netcasts and get the link there. So, thanks to those guys. We're looking forward to working with them more. That's going to do it for this Galactic Netcast, the Alien Invasion number 116. Final thoughts. Brad, you're first.
Boy, this is not something that we really talk about on this show, but our summer movie draft, we're not looking so we finished a respectable third.
You guys did. You two did.
Yes.
So,
correct.
Yeah, because we were like way behind, and now we're just barely.
So what made you caught up? Or was it Guardians?
Guardians
and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Wow, okay. So yeah. Who won it?
Huh, I wonder, Dave Nelson.
I still think April shouldn't have counted.
Team Car Ramrod won. That's who won, Dave.
That's me and Matt Stein. You can catch him on the Sci-Fi Geek Club. And then the other team was actually the Else Nerds guys before they were Else Nerds. They were What We're Watching Weekly, and it's Corey and Gregor, and they came in second place. So congratulations to me and Matt, and for you guys coming in second and third. So that was fun. That was a lot of fun. Can't wait to do that again. All right, Anessa, your final thought.
Dancing Groot Bobble action figure will be released on December 31st. I am excited.
That is awesome.
It's true.
It is. It's like on pre-order for $11 on Amazon. I'm totally going to order it. It's like my birthday present to myself.
I'm guessing that's going
to
be
Happy birthday to me.
I'm guessing that's going to be around the same time the movie gets released on home video and DVD. I'm
Probably.
Guessing.
Also, probably. Happy birthday to me.
Because we celebrate.
It's going to be a good Christmas this year.
Anesmus. It's going to be a good Anesmus this year.
It's going to be a good Anesmus.
Yes.
Just saying.
All right. Thanks a lot for joining us. Yeah. What?
Captain America will be out here. It's out this week, I think.
Oh,
that's right.
Okay. Yeah. Good stuff.
Happy birthday to you.
All right. Now I'm gonna wrap things up. Thanks for joining us for the Alien Invasion. Until next time, we'll talk to you guys later. Leave your hailing frequencies open and scanners on full, because another Galactic Netcast will be approaching your coordinates soon. For more information, go to galacticnetcasts.com.